Do grab a seat, and if you could find a Bible again. We are in Ecclesiastes chapter 3, and it's page 554, continuing our series through the book of Ecclesiastes. Special welcome to Francis Hopkins today. I announced his arrival last week, and this is his first Sunday in church, which is pretty good going for an eight-day-old. So well done him. Page 554, I'm going to read from chapter 3, verse 1. For everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to break down and a time to build up. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to cast away stains and a time to gather stains together. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to seek and a time to lose. A time to keep and a time to cast away. A time to tear and a time to sow. A time to keep silence and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace. What gain has the worker from his toil? I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from beginning to end. I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also, that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done it so that people fear before him. That which is already has been, that which is to be already has been, and God seeks what has been driven away. Moreover, I saw under the sun that in the place of justice, even there was wickedness. And in the place of righteousness, even there was wickedness. I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every matter and for every work. I said in my heart with regard to the children of man that God is testing them, that they may see that they themselves are but beasts. For what happens to the children of man and what happens to the beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beasts, for all is vanity. All go to one place, all are from the dust, and to dust all return. Who knows whether the spirit of man goes upwards and the spirit of the beast goes down into the earth? So I saw that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his work, for that is his lot. Who can bring him to see what will be after him? If you could keep that open, and especially what will be a help to you is the notes on the inside of your service sheet, which have got the headings that we're going to be looking at in our time together. Some people here will have heard, I think it's called a modern parable of the management consultant and the fisherman. Has anyone? It's one of those things that you see all over the internet on social media. And it's kind of pokes fun at our age, really. It's about a management consultant who goes on holiday and he goes to a sleepy fishing village, and he notices there that the fisherman completes all his work in 1 hour. And then he spends the rest of the day with his family, and then he goes out in the evening and plays in a band and then hangs out with his friends. And the consultant approaches him on the beach and says, look, I've got an MBA, and I can tell you how you can improve your life. If you fished, instead of 1 hour, if you fished all day, before long you could have enough yield to buy a whole fleet of boats. And eventually you could move to the city, you could run a fish distribution business, and after a couple of decades you could perhaps sell the shares in your business and possibly even have enough to retire. And after that, asked the fisherman, well, after that, well, you could move out to a fishing village and you could fish in the morning and you could spend the rest of the day with your family and spend the evenings playing in your band and hanging out with your friends. And obviously the fisherman smiles at the man, thinks he's mad, shakes his head and keeps walking up the beach. And the point of the story is that it's meant to poke fun at our society's obsession with gain and with productivity, and especially at the way that it's effectively ruining our lives and making people into super busy stress heads. And I've put there on the sheets, why is it that we are so stressed and so busy? It is a weird thing, isn't it, when you think about our lives. We have so many labour-saving devices, like washing machines, like even supermarket deliveries, so that jobs which would have taken our great-great-grandparents the best part of a week now take literally minutes. And yet somehow we've managed to be busier than ever. And people suggest that often the technology, things like mobile phones and emails, make things even worse. We're now under even greater pressure to reply immediately, and we can never actually leave our work behind. And researchers now try and quantify just how busy we are. Have you come across average pedestrian speeds? And we are now walking 10% faster in London even than 20 years ago, presumably because we're in more of a hurry and we're even more stressed than we were. And it's into this situation that I think this passage is particularly relevant to each of us. Because this passage pushes us back and it says that much of our frantic busyness comes from misunderstanding what is God's role and what is our role in life. So let's get into this passage together. And the first point our writer wants us to see, I put there number one from verses 1-8, is that the seasons of life are beyond our control. And you remember, the passage began with that beautiful poem. For everything, there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal. And so it goes on. And what I love about this poem is that it's so beautifully ambiguous. Do you think it's good news or bad news? Do you think it's a positive poem or a negative poem? Let me explain. We're told at the start that there is a time for every matter under heaven. And the fact that it's under heaven rather than under the sun, which is the phrase we've mainly had until now, we had it 8 times in the first 2 chapters, the switch to under heaven hints that this is very significantly under God's good governance. And heaven in Ecclesiastes is the place where God dwells. And the poem has 14 pairs of times. And you may know that in the Bible, 7 and its multiples is used to symbolize perfection, since God made the world in 7 days. And the poem reminds us, as we're reading through Ecclesiastes, of the magnificent rhythms of the natural world that we saw in that poem in chapter 1. Do you remember the sun rises, the sun goes down? Only here, it's with human activity, a time to be born and a time to die. So initially, it seems very positive. But then we read the first comment at the end of the poem, look at verse 9, and it takes us in a different direction. Verse 9, what gain has the worker from his toil? I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. If you were here last week, you will remember the business from chapter 1:13 and chapter 2:26. It's that unhappy business of futility from living in a cursed world. And from that perspective, we then read the poem quite negatively. And we notice in the poem that there is no gain in it. Think about verse 5, a time to cast away stones, and then a time to gather stones together. Isn't that frustrating? Nothing to show from it. So unproductive. And life's not just unproductive, but it's also out of our control. And this is a theme which is also going to be developed in the comments afterwards. These seasons of life in the poem mostly are things which happen to us without our planning. So for most of us, we don't choose when it is we're born. We don't choose, most of us, when we die. We don't choose when it's a time for war or when it's a time for peace, verse 8. And even down to our emotional responses, verse 4. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. It's not just that we don't have control when someone dies. We don't even control how long it will take to grieve them. Life is so much out of our control. And apart from perhaps that first pair, which I think do fit very well as an opener, for the other pairs, there's no discernible structure. Just like with life, isn't it? Just things get thrown at us willy-nilly, seemingly randomly. So is it good news or bad news? And I think that that is precisely the point of this poem. It's ambiguous. This poem describes life as it is. And whether we receive life as good or as bad actually depends on us and our outlook. So yes, the seasons of life are beyond our control. And therefore, if we are control freaks, if, as we've been seeing so far in Ecclesiastes, we are obsessed with the question of where is gain, like here in verse 9, then this poem, like the seasons of life, will feel very oppressive to us. These things keep getting in the way of my plans. They hamper my productivity. Yet if, as the writer wants to show us, there is a Lord over time, and if there is a God who is good and who is generous and who can be trusted, then actually the fact that life is out of our control might actually be good news. And that brings us on to the next section, point 2 I put on the sheets. Yes, the seasons of life are beyond our control, 1 to 8, but we can trust the Lord of time, 9 to 15. Verse 9, what gain has the worker from his toil? I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. And by now, looking through the book of Ecclesiastes, this is very familiar territory for us. We're back onto this big question that the writer, who we think is probably Solomon, has been interested in throughout. But next, there's some new teaching about God and his relationship to time. Verse 11, he, God, has made everything beautiful in its time. And that phrase, beautiful in its time, has the sense of it's beautifully fitting. Everything's like put together like a well-crafted story. So we may not understand why one scene of life follows another, but God does. And of course, if we had his perspective, we could see that every scene in life is in its perfect place. Also, verse 11, also he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. It's quite a famous verse, and it explains why human beings feel the tension that we do in life. Instinctively, we know there must be some big picture. We sense that there is enduring significance to this world and to what happens in it. There's an eternity in our hearts. Incidentally, that's why people speak often about things like love and justice being not just opinions, but realities, absolutes, even though very often people's worldviews can't support what it is that they know deep down. But the verse says that whilst we know enough to realise there is an eternity, that we and our actions have lasting significance, the verse says we don't see enough. We don't see enough to understand what this big picture is and how each of the scenes that we're in contributes to the whole. So it's a little bit as if, imagine if, you know, each of us were very short-sighted and our noses are pressed up against some great and glorious and beautiful fresco painting, you know, one of those beautiful paintings you see in Italy on plaster. And we can edge along the painting and we can see that it must be amazing, it must be beautiful, but we can't get far enough from it to see it properly, to see exactly what's going on. That's what life is like for us. An inkling that it's beautiful and that it fits together, but we don't know how. And the right response to our smallness and our limited perspective is, I've put on the sheets, to humbly rejoice and to do good. Look at verse 12. I perceived that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. We touched on this issue of acknowledging our Creator and his generosity back in chapter 2. And the new element here is that phrase, do good. So although we don't know how God is going to use each of our actions and each of our lives, because he's the Lord over time, we can trust that he will. He will weave all our experiences and our lives into one glorious story. And so our role is to do good with whatever opportunities we're given. C.S. Lewis, in his essay, The World's Last Night, he captures this idea perfectly. He says, we do not know the play that we're in. We do not even know whether we're in Act 1 or Act 5. We do not know who are the major and who are the minor characters. The author knows. The audience, if angels and archangels and all the company of heaven fill the pit and the stalls, may have an inkling. But we never see the play from the outside. We never meet any characters except that tiny minority who are on in the same scenes as ourselves. We are wholly ignorant of the future and very imperfectly informed about the past. That the play has a meaning, we may be sure, but we cannot see it. When it is over, the author will have something to say to each one of us on the part that each of us has played. The playing it well is what matters infinitely. He's capturing there that part of acknowledging that God is Lord over time and that we are not is playing our role, humbly rejoicing and doing good and leaving the rest to him. And not only, our writer says, are we to do good and to rejoice, but also we are to let any frustration lead us to worship. So in verse 14, we discover more about God as the master playwright. Have a look at verse 14. I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. He's this amazing artist who's creating this grand and glorious fresco. He's the playwright. He not only sees the beginning from the end, but who is weaving every part of the plot into one glorious story. Verse 14, nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. So for us, as mere actors on the stage, we play our part, certainly, but we don't ultimately control the big plot. And this tension that we feel, knowing that there is a grand and glorious plot, but not knowing how exactly we contribute, and this tension of knowing that we're not ultimately in control of that plot, all of this tension, all of this frustration that we feel is deliberate. God has done it for a reason. And what is that reason? Well, let's look at verse 14 again. I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done it, here we go, so that people fear before him. Now that phrase, fear before, it means to fear in God's presence. It means to reverently approach in worship. As we saw last week, God has deliberately frustrated this world. He did it when our first ancestors rebelled. And particularly in view in this chapter is the frustration of not being in control of the seasons of life and also discovering that they're ultimately unproductive. And yet God's purpose is that we take all of that frustration and we turn it into worship. So every time that life doesn't go as planned, and we can take that from the micro, you know, you're stuck in the traffic jam, or the macro, you're in a season of bereavement or of disability. In fact, every time we sense this life is out of control and unproductive, that is an opportunity for us to say, well, God is in control, not me. He is the Lord of time. He's the great playwright. And my job is just to bow before him and worship him. If you think about it, this is a very positive and practical chapter. So yes, the seasons of life are beyond our control, but isn't it wonderful to know they're not beyond the Lord's control? So if we're receiving blessing right now, well, rejoice and do good. You know it's from his hand. If you're feeling frustration right now, well, lean into it. It's deliberate. Let it do its work of leading us to acknowledge our smallness and God's greatness so that we can turn that into worship. And that is worship, both in the general sense, including things like, verse 12, rejoicing and doing good, but especially here, worship in that narrow sense. The kind of thing spoken of, for example, in Acts 13, where the church were gathered together to worship the Lord. That narrow time of giving him our heart's devotion in song and in prayer. And of course, the things that we do when we're gathered are then to overflow into the rest of our lives as well, as we find opportunities to fear before him throughout the week. Whether that's for you with your headphones on your commute, or whether it's on your knees with your housemates or your family or wherever it is. We're to let our struggles and our frustrations lead us to fear before him. We're to turn it back into worship. And verse 15 closes this section by reminding us that we really can trust this Lord of time. Look at verse 15. That which is already has been. That which is to be already has been. And God seeks what has been driven away. I love that last bit of the verse. So the verse is saying that human toil cannot produce ultimate gain. And we've seen that through the last 2 weeks. And yet God will judge in his good time. And when it says God seeks what has been driven away, I take it that it's a beautiful assurance that even those things lost in the past, projects lost, relationships lost, hopes lost, even those things which are unrecoverable for us can be called back by God. Nothing will be lost ultimately for those who trust him, the God who judges. So we can trust the Lord of time, even with what to us is lost in the past. What a God we worship. And this chapter concludes by dealing next with two potential challenges to this teaching. And it asserts that we can trust the Lord of time, point three, even in the face of injustice and of death. And that's the last section, 16 to 22. Now, when Solomon speaks about God having this big, enduring, overarching plan, as we saw in verse 14, and saying that he makes everything beautiful and fitting in its time, he's not saying that because he's unaware of injustice and things going wrong in this world. I think that's what people often assume, isn't it? When Christians say, well, God is working all things for good, which is what the Apostle Paul said in Romans 8. People assume those kinds of people just haven't ventured out much beyond their leafy, protected suburb to see what the world is really like. But Solomon says, verse 16, moreover, I saw under the sun that in the place of justice, even there was wickedness. And in the place of righteousness, even there was wickedness. He's saying, listen, I have seen real wickedness. And I've seen it even amongst the police force and amongst the judiciary. I've seen it in those places where if they are corrupt, there's no hope for justice anywhere else. But none of that undermines what I've said. Because, as I put on the sheets, all injustice will be overturned. This is verse 17. I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked. For there is a time for every matter and for every work. Isn't that glorious? We do not live in an amoral, purposeless universe. Every wrong will one day be righted. And that is fabulous news. And next he goes on to address the problem of death. And again, this is one of the things where people say, look at death. How can you say that God has a good plan? When the fact that every life ends in death surely undermines that claim. Doesn't it cry out that this world is really futile and meaningless underneath? Now, it's worth pointing out, if you were to read the next verses in this chapter, completely rip them out of context, you might conclude that whoever's writing them didn't know about the fact of judgment and didn't know about the final resurrection. But of course, we've just read verse 17, haven't we? Only one verse ago, the preacher has explained about the reality of a final judgment for human beings, which necessarily entails a final resurrection and two different destinies. So this preacher is not ignorant. Rather, he's saying that death, instead of being a reason for us to start distrusting God and saying, God, if he's there, he must be out of control, rather, the whole point of death, as I put on the sheets, is to humble us. Verse 18, I said in my heart, with regard to the children of man, that God is testing or exposing them, that they may see that they themselves are but beasts. If you know the Bible, you will know that ever since our first ancestors, human beings have made a bid to try and be God, effectively. To say that we, rather than God, we will define what is right, what's wrong. We'll live however we see fit. And so for us who claim to be gods, God decreed that our fate would be like the animals, returning to the dust from which we were created. And there's little that's more ungodlike, is there, than death. And that's the point of it. It's supposed to bring us down a notch and to humble us. Look at verse 19. For what happens to the children of man and what happens to the beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beast, for all is vanity. All go to one place, all are from the dust, and to dust all return. Who knows whether the spirit of man goes upwards and the spirit of the beast goes down into the earth? So yes, the spirit of man does go upwards. In fact, the writer Solomon specifically says, this is in chapter 12, verse 7, that after death, the dust returns to the earth and the spirit returns to God who gave it. He knows that. But the point here is that to an observer, to someone looking on when they see someone dying, that is not obvious. You can't see it happening. And that's the point here. Death is a message to humanity to humble us and to say, you're just like animals. So the point of this last section here is that injustice and death, these things, far from undermining our confidence that God is in sovereign control, rightly understood, these things should do the opposite. So when we see or when we experience injustice that we can't put right ourselves, we're to let it remind us that God will put it right one day. And therefore that's a prompt to trust him. Or when we see death and we see the way it laughs at human achievements, we're to let that remind us that we are more like beasts than we are like gods, and that therefore we should humble ourselves and trust him. And so as we close, the wonderful call of this chapter is for us to embrace the freedom that comes from accepting that we are limited and we are finite and we are creatures. That is good news. There's a famous Victorian poem called Invictus, which you probably have heard, which goes like this. It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishments the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. And that poem is suggesting that freedom comes from a proud defiance of our creatureliness, from pretending that I am the Lord over time, when actually that job is already taken. And when we do that and we live in a make-believe world, that is not freedom, that is effectively slavery. M. Scott Peck, in his book The Road Less Traveled, he put it this way: as soon as we believe that it is possible for a man to become God, we can never really rest for long. Never say, okay, my job is done. We must constantly push ourselves to greater and greater wisdom, greater and greater effectiveness. By this belief, we will have trapped ourselves, at least until death, on an effortful treadmill of self-improvement. So much of our stress, so much of our relentless busyness comes from a failure to distinguish between what should be on God's to-do list and what should be on our to-do list. So God's to-do list includes things like planning everything that happens across our lives and deciding when is the time to weep and when is the time to laugh and so on. And it's his job to weave together all the scenes of this life into one coherent and glorious whole. And it's his job to ultimately fix every injustice, and so on and so on. And actually that comes as a great relief, because it means that my to-do list is therefore much, much more manageable. So I'm still called to joyfully acknowledge my Creator and be thankful for his gifts. We saw that especially in chapter 1. I'm still called to turn my frustrations into worship and to remember that he is God and I'm not. And yes, I'm still called to do good. And where I can, I should be putting right injustice and serving God with the gifts I've been given. But crucially, we've now been freed from having to take God's to-do list onto our shoulders as well. And we're freed at the end of each day to put our tools down and to leave them down. Not just doing one last email. Trusting that God will keep this world spinning even when we go to sleep. And we can rest in that. And incidentally, this call to do good and to serve God with the gifts we've been given is, I think, where the parable of the management consultant and the fisherman that may actually send us off in the wrong direction. Did you notice in that parable, it seems to suggest that the good life is the leisurely life. That's not what Solomon thinks. And we're going to see later in this book, in chapter 9, verse 10, we're told, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. This chapter is not a call to laziness. It is a call to trust. And as we trust him, we will discover a freedom to embrace the seasons God has given us. We will be freed to roll with the rhythms of the poem of this life. So if I wake early and I can't get back to sleep, that's not what I planned. Well, maybe the Lord's opening up an unexpected opportunity to pray. Or if I'm with one of the children and the public transport is not behaving, that's not what I've planned. Well, maybe the Lord's decided it's time for some father-daughter time that I hadn't scheduled. Or if chicken pox has scuppered the family holiday to France that we'd been so looking forward to. Well, maybe that's an opportunity to reflect as a family on what it is to live in a cursed world and to look forward to a new world that's coming. And if we're in an unwelcome season, an unplanned, an unproductive season of life, ill health, bereavement, some struggle, what a difference it will make to know that there is a Lord of time. There is someone behind all of this whom we can trust. There is a great fresco artist, a great playwright. There is one who has an enduring overarching plan, and he will make everything beautiful in its time. And wonderfully, he can even be trusted to recover those things lost in the past, which seem so unrecoverable to us. And with this kind of a God, we can therefore trust him completely. I'm going to leave a time of quiet, and you may want to look at the verses or the coffee questions and to reflect, therefore, coffee downstairs or during the week. And then in a minute or two, we'll have our prayers led for us.